So a few weeks ago, we began in Revelation, and we have already been introduced to the rider on the white horse. There are two riders on the white horse. The first rider on the white horse we meet in Revelation chapter 6. And so if we go there, we'll see that. Yep, we talked about the white horse. So if we look in Revelation chapter 6, the first seal is opened. And with each of the first four seals, there is a different horseman or a different rider on a horse who comes. And the first one who comes out is the rider on the white horse, and he's holding a bow, and he goes out conquering and to conquer. And this person has been kind of interpreted in two ways throughout church history. Sometimes in church history, this person has been interpreted as Jesus. This is an image of Jesus opening the seals, and Jesus goes out to conquer the world and to win the world for himself. I don't take that view. I believe that this is the Antichrist. And so we get a soft introduction in Revelation to Antichrist. But then we see, as we move forward, as we get into the ninth and tenth chapters, and then later, we begin to see, after we get into chapter 11, that there is this beast that comes. And there are people who are witnessing for God, and there is a beast who slays them. We see in verse 7, chapter 11, verse 7. Now, when they have finished their testimony, the beast that comes up from out of the abyss will attack them. Now, we mentioned, or I mentioned a few weeks ago, that abyss comes from the Greek word abusan, and it means that it's this idea of the extreme deep part of the sea. We're also going to see later that he's called the beast that comes out of the sea. There's this expression. And so this is important imagery that we want to see. And so I said, this is clearly the Antichrist. This is Satan's Superman. This is the enemy of all that is holy. This is who was talked about by Paul in 2 Thessalonians when he talks about the man of lawlessness. Now, the book that talks the most about Antichrist, other than Revelation, is the book of Daniel. And Daniel, I did kind of a brief overview, looking back on it, back about 3 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago, when we introduced the book of Daniel. I really wasn't as organized as I wanted to be. And so, those of you who are here, I apologize. That study was, it just didn't go the way I thought it was going to. But what we see in Daniel is there is a coherent theme in the entire book of Daniel. The coherent theme, the thing that holds all of the book of Daniel together, is this statement that God is sovereign over the kingdoms of the world, and he gives them to whoever he wishes. This is the point that Nebuchadnezzar learns. We see that Nebuchadnezzar, Daniel warns him, right? Nebuchadnezzar is proud, he's arrogant, and Daniel warns him. He says, "Humble yourself, do good, help the oppressed, and God will allow you to continue on your throne. But if you don't, if you continue to rebel against God, if you continue to do what is evil, if you continue to have your heart proud and lifted up, God will bring you down." And Nebuchadnezzar, of course, did not listen to the warning, and he went mad. He lost his mind. He was sitting there, he was looking out on Babylon, and he said, "Is this not great Babylon, which I have built?" And immediately he lost his mind. He went out, he lived like an animal for years, and eventually they found him and they brought him back. After he looked up to heaven, he acknowledged God, and his kingdom was restored. And Nebuchadnezzar talks about how there is no one greater than the God of Daniel. There is no one who is greater than Yahweh. There is no God but that God. And God, the God we worship, the Yahweh, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, is sovereign over the kingdoms of the world. That's what Daniel is all about. It's about God's sovereignty over the world, God's sovereignty and control of world empires, and how God is going to establish a world empire that will supplant and take the place and remove all other world empires. Now, we see the first hint of this in Daniel chapter 2. So, Daniel chapter 2, Nebuchadnezzar has a dream. You guys are all pretty familiar with this, but Nebuchadnezzar has a dream, and in his dream, he sees this statue, this multi-metallic image. Now, we talked about this last time we got together, but I want to give us some review. He sees this image, and this image has a head of gold, a chest and arms of silver, a belly and thighs of bronze, legs of iron, and feet of iron mixed with clay. And in his dream, he sees a rock cut out, but not with human hands. And this rock comes and smashes the feet of this statue, of this image. And the whole image falls down and crumbles into dust. And the wind blows the dust away. But the rock becomes a great mountain. And what this symbolizes, Daniel explains it, is that there are four great world empires that will exist throughout history. And we know really, really well what these four world empires are. The first is Nebuchadnezzar's Babylonian Empire. It did not last long. It lasted less than 70 years, probably about 30 or 40. I don't know the number off the top of my head. It was a very short empire, but it was a world empire. And when we say world empire, we don't mean that it had conquered everywhere in the world. What we mean is that it had power around the Mediterranean. It had conquered the Mediterranean world, because that's what biblical history focuses on. The biblical history focuses on the Mediterranean world. What's the Mediterranean world? Would be northern Africa, southern Europe, over Asia Minor with Turkey and all that area. So conquering the world, being the world empire, means having control of the Mediterranean, the Great Sea. There are four great empires that are going to do that. The first is Nebuchadnezzar's short-lived empire, but it was glorious. The second is the Medo-Persian Empire. Now, the Medo-Persian Empire is called the Medo-Persian Empire because it was a combination of the Medes and the Persians. The Persians, we know who the Persians are. They're the Iranians. Most people don't know who the Medes are. The Medes are the modern-day Kurdish people. So the Kurds, when you hear about the Kurds and they're allied with the United States, the Kurds are the ancient Medes. They, somewhere along the line, the name got changed. I don't know when. But that's who they were. So the Kurds, who lived in these border areas, they unite with the Persians. They come, they overthrow the Babylonian Empire. A great story of how they overthrow them. They came, and everybody thought Babylon couldn't be conquered. Well, they got their guys some shovels, and they started to redirect the river that ran through Babylon. They drained the canal, and then the armies just marched in and conquered the city like that. And so the Medo-Persian Empire conquers. The Medo-Persian Empire rules until Alexander the Great comes. Alexander the Great comes and he overthrows the Medo-Persian Empire. He sets up a very short-lived world empire under himself, and then his empire breaks into at least four large parts, two of which the Bible is really concerned with are the empires of the Ptolemies, or the Ptolemies, if you want to read it that way, the Ptolemies who ruled Egypt, and the Seleucids who rule modern-day Syria. Back then it was called Aram, or the Arameans, or the people of Damascus, the Damascenes, and Daniel later talks a lot about them. The fourth great world empire that we talk about is the Roman Empire. Now, the Roman Empire is described as the legs of iron, and we know that the Roman Empire made great use of iron. They had iron swords. They did not use brass or bronze swords. They used iron. They used the iron short sword. They were a very powerful empire, and they were hard. And the Roman Empire was durable. It endured for over 1,000 years. And a lot of people, a lot of Bible historians would say that the Roman Empire in a shattered and scattered form continues to rule the world today, because the great powers of Europe and their descendants, which would be the United States, Russia, they continue to have major power in world events, and they control the Mediterranean, which is the most important part. So Daniel gives this, and then he says there's coming another empire, and the empire that will replace all of them, and we, of course, believe that that is the empire of Messiah, that is the Messianic kingdom. Now, when we look in Daniel, we see that there's another section, and we're going to turn there right now. We're going to Daniel chapter 7, and we get kind of a review of the material that we looked at before. Daniel is going to get this he's going to get this information about world history in several different ways. And God is doing this, one, in keeping with what we know about biblical prophecy. When a vision is given in multiple different ways, it means that the vision is being confirmed and certain. Also, so that we can understand different things about the material. So we're going to start in Daniel chapter 7, verse 1, and I'm hoping that we can get through all of chapter 7 tonight, but it is a lot. And remember, the reason we're studying this is to understand how God, not only how God acts in history, but how God is leading up to the Antichrist, how God is building up to his great man of sin. All right, so Chapter 7, verse 1. I'm reading from the NIV. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream, and visions passed through his mind as he was lying on his bed. He wrote down the substance of the dream. Daniel said, "In my vision at night I looked, and there before me were the four winds of heaven, churning up the great sea. Four great beasts, each different from the others, came up out of the sea. The first was like a lion, and it had the wings of an eagle. I watched until its wings were torn off, and it was lifted from the ground so that it stood on 2 feet like a man, and the heart of a man was given to it. And there before me was a second beast, which looked like a bear. It was raised up on one of its sides, and it had 3 ribs in its mouth between its teeth, and it was told, 'Get up and eat your fill of flesh.' After that I looked, and there before me was another beast, one that looked like a leopard, and on its back it had 4 wings like those of a bird. This beast had 4 heads, and it was given authority to rule. After that, in my vision at night, I looked, and there before me was a 4th beast, terrifying and frightening and very powerful. It had large iron teeth. It crushed and devoured its victims and trampled underfoot whatever was left. It was different from all the former beasts, and it had 10 horns. While I was thinking about the horns, there before me was another horn, a little horn, which came up among them, and 3 of the 1st horns were uprooted before it. The horn had eyes like the eyes of a man and a mouth that spoke boastfully." We're going to pause right there, and we're going to interpret the rest. Actually, no, we're going to keep going. As I looked, verse 9, thrones were set in place, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. His clothing was as white as snow. The hair on his head was white like wool. His throne was was flaming with fire, and the wheels were all ablaze. A river of fire was flowing, coming out from before him. Thousands upon thousands attended him. 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The court was seated, and the books were opened. Then I continued to watch because of the boastful words of the horn that he was speaking. I kept looking until the beast was slain and its body destroyed and thrown into the blazing fire. The other beasts had been stripped of their authority, but they were allowed to live for a period of time. In my vision at night, I looked, and there before me was one like a son of man, coming with the clouds of heaven. As he approached the Ancient of Days, he was led into his presence. He was given authority, glory, and sovereign power. All peoples, nations, and men of every language worshipped him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion, and it will not pass away, and his kingdom is one that will never be destroyed. Okay, so with all of that introduction tonight, looking at Daniel chapter 7, specifically the verses we looked at, verses 1 through 14, what things stand out to you guys? What are the things that you guys think are really important? Things that, that are worth talking about. Yeah, that's a really good point, and we will get to that when we go verse by verse through this. But yes, that's a really good point. What is this man's heart? What does that mean? Is that a good thing? Is that a bad thing? Because the heart of man isn't necessarily a good thing, but that's definitely worth talking about. Other things that stand out to us. Yeah. The last beast is certainly the most powerful of all the beasts, and that's a good point. Yeah, Jim. Yeah, the repetition of the word beast is really pretty on the nose. I think is John is trying to make sure that we don't miss this. Anything else that really stands out before us? Yeah. Ultimately, all of these kingdoms are going to be supplanted, which. There's a really interesting verse in here that we'll come to towards the end, which is really interesting. So what's really important here to notice, and again, I know that this sounds really obvious when I say it, but it might not seem obvious, is the amazing parallel between Nebuchadnezzar's dream of the statue, and not just the dream itself, but the way everything progresses. So you think about Nebuchadnezzar's dream. It was a statue that he saw that had 4 primary parts, and then a 5th part that was part of the 4th, right? What do we see here? We see 4 beasts, and then we see part of the 4th beast is this little horn, right? And notice, there are 10 toes, right? But how many How many horns are there? There are 10 horns. We see these repetitions and we see these ideas. Notice as well that the head of gold, Daniel explains that the head of gold is special. There's something special about the head of gold. And what do we see about the beast? The first beast that's mentioned gets special treatment. It's not treated the same way as all of these other beasts. In fact, when you look at it, it's treated with quite a bit of honor, and there's some important change that happens, which Deanne kind of clued us in to think, okay, well, what does that mean? When she asked, what does it mean that it was given a heart of a man? Notice as well that we see a parallel, that these empires, these beasts, are supplanted, and they're supplanted by God himself. And not only are they supplanted by God himself, but look at what happens. We see the destruction of the beast. Now, we could go forward into Revelation right now, and we could go to Revelation and see at the chapter 19 through 21, we see kind of what this is fulfilling, which is the beast is taken, he's thrown. Where is he thrown? He's cast into the lake of fire. Where is this beast? Where is the horn that spoke words? His body is destroyed, and he's thrown into the blazing fire. The other beasts are stripped away. So we see this unmistakable parallel between the first series of the first vision that Nebuchadnezzar, it's Nebuchadnezzar's vision. Never forget that. It's Nebuchadnezzar's vision when we see the multi-metallic image. Daniel interprets it, but that image was given to a Gentile king, and a Gentile king who had done rather bad things to Israel as well. So we see the parallels. We also want to see the parallels of what John is doing with this material. So John doesn't tell us anything about the first three beasts. In fact, he doesn't tell us anything about the fourth beast until we get to the point where there are the 10 horns or the 10 toes. We don't pick up the story. John picks up this story after the Roman Empire has now kind of disintegrated and has become this fractured empire. But he picks up the story essentially in verse 8 when he sees the little horn. That's where John picks up the story. That's where God gives John the vision in Revelation. So we want to understand, how does this work? How does this fit in? What can we learn about Antichrist? So the first thing I want us to see when we look at the lion is that the lion is not a lion. That sounds pretty obvious, right? The lion is not a lion. How do you know it's not a lion, Luke? Because lions don't have wings of eagles. Now, there's a Bible teacher, I listened to him for the first time today, and he said, you know, we've seen lions mixed with tigers, we've seen ligers, but we've never seen a lion mixed with an eagle. We've never seen a legal, right? or an eagion. We've never seen anything like that. So this is clearly a mythological creature or a wonderful or fantastical creature. Why is there the symbolism of the lion and the eagle? What's the purpose? Why those animal parts? That's a great way to put it. The lion is the king of the beast, the eagle is the king of the air. And not only is the eagle the king of the air, but a lot of people believe that the eagle is symbolic of divinity, because the eagle soars above everything else, and so it transcends the normal plane of existence, right? So we have something very special about this first beast. It's glorious. Just like the golden beast, just like the head of gold, there's something special about this beast. It has the wings of an eagle, but what happens to it? Its wings were torn off, and it was lifted from the ground so that it stood on the feet like a man. So the empire loses its power, but there's something special that happens, which is that this beast then gets up and is transformed into a man. I think, and I could be wrong about this, but I think that what this is talking about Nebuchadnezzar. I think that this is the clue that makes sure that we know that this is Babylon. Those details are given so that we know that it's Babylon. Why? Because those words were used to describe describe Nebuchadnezzar. Where do we see it? We see, if we go back to chapter 4, right? Nebuchadnezzar has the image of a tree, and he says that, am I in the right spot here? I'm sorry, verse 4, chapter 4. Nebuchadnezzar has this dream, we see that all of this happened to King Nebuchadnezzar. All of what? Well, verse 28 says, all of this happens happened to King Nebuchadnezzar. Daniel interpreted his dream. The dream that he had, go all the way back to verse 13. So we have to keep working backwards. We get all the way back to verse 13. And he had the vision of the tree. And then it said, let him be drenched, verse 15, let him be drenched with the dew of heaven, and let him live like the animals among the plants. Let his mind, verse 16, let his mind be changed from that of a man, and let him be given the mind of an animal until seven times pass by for him. Okay, so this is interesting because I did not check the Hebrew or the Aramaic on this. I haven't. But typically the word for heart and mind are the same word in the Old Testament. Okay, I can't guarantee that it is here, but we see this decision is announced. It's certain. Daniel interprets the dream. He's afraid. Daniel doesn't want to interpret the dream for the king, and the king says, "Don't worry, Belteshazzar. Just say the truth." And he said, verse 23, "You, O king, saw a messenger, a holy one, coming down from heaven and saying, 'Cut down the tree and destroy it, but leave the stump bound with iron and bronze in the grass of the field while its roots remain in the ground. Let him be drenched with the dew of heaven. Let him live like the wild animals until seven times pass by for him.'" We assume that means 7 years, but I don't know what else it would mean, actually. "This is the interpretation, O king." So Daniel gets down to brass tacks in verse 24. "And this is the decree the Most High has issued against the Lord my king. You will be driven away from people and will live like the wild animals. You will eat grass like cattle and be drenched with the dew of heaven. Seven times will pass by before you acknowledge that the Most High is sovereign over the kingdoms of men, and he gives them to anyone he wishes. The command to leave the stump of the tree and its roots means that your kingdom will be restored to you when you acknowledge that heaven rules. Therefore, O king," and then he says, you know, just listen to God. Stop being so proud. And we skipping ahead to verse 34, "At the end of that time, I, Nebuchadnezzar," here we go. Verse 33, "Immediately what had been said about Nebuchadnezzar was fulfilled. He was driven away from people and he ate grass like cattle. His body was drenched with the dew of heaven." Now listen to this. "Until his hair grew like the feathers of an eagle and his nails were like the claws of a bird. At the end of that time, I, Nebuchadnezzar, raised my eyes towards heaven, and my sanity was restored to me." He went from having the mind of an animal to having the mind of a man again. "And I praise the Most High God." Verse 36, "His sanity returns to him. His nobles restored him. They brought back his throne. And now he exalts the God of heaven, and he commands all over that everywhere and everyone worships the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob." Now, I say all that to say, I think that the reason why we have this comment about the heart of a man was given to it is so that we make sure that we understand that the first animal is the Babylonian kingdom. How do we know it's the Babylonian kingdom? Because it's personified by Nebuchadnezzar. You really can't miss that this is Nebuchadnezzar if you're paying attention to what's happening in the book of Daniel, right? But we already know that Nebuchadnezzar's empire is going to pass by. He's already told Nebuchadnezzar this. So what's going to happen? Then there was a second beast, which looked like a bear. Now, is a bear is an animal that's used on, you know, heraldic crests. You know, people would have a bear on their shields. But the bear isn't the king of the beasts. He's not the king of the forest. The bear is powerful, of course, but it's inferior to the lion, at least in, we don't call it the king of the beasts, right? And it's a brute animal. It's not as fast. It doesn't have the roar like a lion, like we think of a lion's roar. It's a different animal. It's not as graceful as a lion. It's lumbering. It's brutal. And it was raised up on one of its sides. So we assume that it means like left to right, this kind of hunched up and not, I mean, because bears are already kind of hunched up on their backside. You know, they kind of lean forward already. So I think what it means is one of these. What does that mean? It means that one side was stronger than the other, and it had three ribs in its mouth between its teeth, and it was told, "Get up and eat your fill of flesh." Okay, this is the Persian Empire, the Medo-Persian Empire. Why is it raised up on one of its sides? Because the Persians were stronger than the Medes. The Medes allied with the Persians, but they were a weaker partner. They were the junior partner in that alliance. And so while the Medes were there and they had Median nobles and Median princes and generals, it was really the Persians who were the senior partners in that relationship. And so we see that one side of the bear is stronger. And they went out and they had three ribs in their mouth. And some commentators have said that the Persian Empire won three great battles. There were three major battles that they won. There are other interpretations of that. The problem with stuff like that is it can kind of get a little tough because it depends on, like, well, how do you define winning a great battle and stuff like that. So take it for what you want. But what we see is that it's told to get up and eat its fill of flesh. The Persian Empire is out to conquer. And they go out to conquer. And what happens to the Persian Empire? Well, if you know your history, the Persian Empire decides, we're going to go conquer. They do not want a free bunch of Greek city-states to the north. They want total control over the Mediterranean. And so what do? They're not happy to just have, you know, generalized control. They want direct control. And so they go and they say, we're gonna fight. And they try to invade, and there's the famous Battle of Thermopylae. Remember the Battle of Thermopylae? There were 300 Spartans who stood there at the hot passes, the Thermopylae, the hot passes, and they held back the Persian Empire long enough for the rest of the Greek city-states to send their soldiers and drive the Persians back, and the Persian Empire lost a lot of men in a great shipwreck. Well, then the Persian Empire tries to do it again. They just really wanted to conquer Greece, and so they sent another army, and then they lost at the Battle of Marathon. And it was this huge thing. Well, so the Persian Empire is greedy for gain. It wants to go out, but it's not able to break the Greeks. They called it the Anti-Persian League. There was the Greeks actually started to unite because of their fear of Persia. And Persia signed its own death warrant when it did this. Persia thought that it could go and attack and conquer Greece because the Greeks were disorganized. They were not united. Persia had this mighty empire, and it was able to draw all of these forces, but Persia had a problem. Does anybody know what Persia's problem with trying to invade Greece was? The Persian Empire was a desert empire. A lot of the Near East, it's very hot. I mean, not that Greece doesn't get hot, but it's very hot, and there were a lot of poor people. It was an army that was light. It was a lightly armored army. They literally had wicker armor. Their armor was, they didn't, you're rolling your eyes, right? Wicker armor. But why? Because they were going through these hot, arid places, and they didn't want to have heavy armor. They were light infantry. That was what they were all about. The Greeks were not light infantry. The Greeks were famous for the phalanx, and the phalanx was a group of men who stood with round shields, shoulder to shoulder, rank upon rank, with spears. A lot of times they were just the same length spear, but sometimes they had spears that would extend, and we'll get to that in a second. But they would stand shoulder to shoulder as tightly as they could. And what did they have? They had helmets that covered most of their face, made out of bronze. They had greaves. A lot of times their greaves are like kind of the catcher's shin guards things that you see, but they were made of bronze. They had bronze shields and leather, a lot of times leather, but sometimes chainmail or sometimes bronze-plated breastplates, but typically it was just leather. But they stood behind these shields with these spears, and they carried swords as well, and they're standing in a tight unit where they're packed in. It's just a wall of spears and bronze shields. Now, what chance does an army carrying wicker shields with leather armor have against the Greek phalanx? Zero. History tells us they have zero. Now, the Persians had excellent cavalry, they had excellent archers, and they did have some heavy infantry. Don't think that they didn't have any, but they were not nearly as capable and as competent as the Greeks were. The Greeks had a much better infantry. It wasn't until hundreds of years later that the Roman legion system was able to defeat the phalanx. But they go and they attack, and the Greeks defeat them, but the Greeks, because of their fear of the Persians, because the Persian Empire was gigantic and it could muster all of these soldiers, the Greeks had to unite. They had the Anti-Persian League. And so they started to kind of hang out together a little bit. And they're like, well, okay, I mean, Athens doesn't really like Sparta, and they're both competing with each other to see who's going to have power over the Greek islands, but we're going to get together for a while. And then they defeat the Persians. And the Persian Empire kind of just takes a chill pill for a little bit. They're kind of licking their wounds. And then a major event happens around 400 BC, which is right around the time biblical history stops. There's a major war in Greece. Does anybody know the name of it off the top of their head? I don't have my wallet. I would offer a dollar if anybody knew it. But it was called the Peloponnesian War. Thucydides, the great Greek historian, wrote the history of the Peloponnesian War. What happened in the... Well, I won't go into why the Peloponnesian War happened, but it was a war, and it depleted the Athenians and the Spartans. Both the Athenian and the Spartan cities were so weakened through this war that in the end, Philip of Macedon was able to become the chief guy in the anti-Persian League. Well, what did Philip of Macedon do? Well, he conquered the Greek islands. He conquered the Greek city-states. And he put his son, Alexander, in charge. Well, and when I say he put his son, Alexander, in charge, I mean Alexander killed his dad and took over. So, Alexander the Great, and interestingly, how you got to kill a lot of people if you want to be called somebody the Great. Well, Alexander the Great then takes over the Greek League. He takes over this thing, and he said, hey, these guys keep invading us. Let's just kill them, and then they can't invade us anymore. And so they did. They went and they conquered the Persian Empire. And that's what we see with this leopard. After that, I looked, verse 6, and there before me was another beast, one that looked like a leopard. And on its back, it had four wings like those of a bird. This beast had four heads and was given authority to rule. Okay. So we see right away that it's a leopard. It's very fast, it's very ferocious, it's vicious and cruel. But what do we see? Four wings, four heads. Why do we see this repetition of four? Because the empire is going to break up into four. The four great generals of Alexander are going to be the ones who kind of carry on the empire for a while. And notice it was given authority to rule. We haven't seen this before, have we? There's something interesting about this that we haven't seen that expression. Now, I mean, the lion with the wings of an eagle certainly had authority to rule, as did the bear. They both had authority to rule, but it's said here specifically about the leopard. And I have no idea why it says that. If you guys read a commentary or hear a sermon or if you guys have some ideas, let me know your ideas, because I have no clue why it's there. I just know that it's kind of strange. Then verse 7. After that, in my vision at night, I looked, and there before me was a fourth beast, terrifying and frightening and very powerful. Okay, three descriptions, three explanations. It was terrifying and it was frightening. Kind of the same thing, Daniel, you know, maybe work on your English, but terrifying and frightening and very powerful. All of these beasts are powerful, right? All of these beasts are powerful, but this one is described as being very powerful. And then it said, we see, it had large iron teeth. Okay, how many animals do you guys know of that have iron teeth?
None.
Exactly, none, right? What animal is this described as? What animal is this? Yeah, there's no specific animal. There's nothing that stands out as being what this creature is. We see that the one beast is a lion that has eagle wings. I mean, but it's still like a lion. That's the primary description. The second beast is a bear. I mean, that's just a bear. It's a kind of a weird crippled bear, but it's a bear. The third beast is a leopard with four heads and four wings, which, you know, I haven't seen any four-headed leopards, but it's still like a leopard. The primary description is a leopard. All of these creatures have a primary description, except for this one. This one does not have a primary description. It's indescribable. There's nothing like it. There's nothing, and I think there are probably a lot of reasons why this one doesn't get a description. One, the Roman Empire was in some ways unique. It was unique because it was made up of a multitude of different peoples. The Roman Empire started among the Romans. But later, we see people from all kinds of ethnicities who are gaining citizenship. The Roman Empire covered all of Europe and North Africa and Asia Minor. I mean, it was everywhere. And there wasn't one single creature that represents it. But there's this terrifying beast that Daniel can't even describe. And the presence of iron. It had iron teeth, large iron teeth, and it crushed and devoured its victims. And it trampled underfoot whatever was left. And it was different from all the former beasts, and it had 10 horns. Now, how is this beast different? Well, we already saw that it was different because it didn't have a primary animal description, right? But how else is this animal different? Because it didn't have wings. Okay, that makes it different from two of the four. That's a good observation. I think what makes it different is this beast is not overthrown until the end times. This beast is not supplanted until the end. All the other beasts are supplanted by another beast. The fourth beast is not overthrown by another beast. It continues to go on. And so what we see is that it continues, but in a weird way, because we stop focusing even on the beast, whatever it is, and then we start focusing on its horns. Now remember, this is very similar to the statue, where the statue has legs of iron and then feet of iron and clay mixed together. And so we see that there are the 10 horns, there are the 10 toes, but there's one of them in particular that stands out, and this is the little horn. And it gets up and it speaks blasphemous words. It speaks boastfully. Now, if we were to go forwards in Daniel, and we may as well, actually, if we're to go forward into Daniel, we're going to see that there is... Look at chapter 11, verse 36. Now, we already covered this a little bit last time we were together. We were giving an overview of this. But we see, the king will do as he pleases. He will exalt and magnify himself above every god and will say unheard of things against the God of gods. He will be successful until the time of wrath is completed, for what has been determined must take place. And it continues to go on talking about this king. But what do we see? The king who exalts himself, who survives until he's overthrown by Messiah, we read about in chapters 11 and 12, is the same as the little horn, who's the same as the beast of Revelation chapter 11, and really Revelation, all of Revelation from chapter 6, chapter 11, 12, 13, 19, many places. This beast is the same thing. It's the same. They're all describing the beast. They're all describing the Antichrist. Every one of these places, and they're giving us different ways of describing him. Now, verses nine and following. I'm going to move rather hurriedly through this. But what we see is, as was already mentioned, Deanne says thrones were set in place, and the Ancient of Days took his seat. His clothing was as white as snow. The hair of his head was white like wool. His throne. We read about this, about the river of fire and all of these attending him. Where have we seen language like this? We've seen language like this in Revelation when we see the vision of heaven, right? We're seeing things very similar. Ezekiel, we see very similar language, you know, like the wheels within wheels. We see similar language in all of these apocalyptical books of the Bible. But what do we see specifically? The seating on the thrones were set in place. Thrones, plural, and they were set in place. That suggests that the thrones aren't always there. See, this is why you go and study theology at a seminary, so you can make observations like this. Thrones were set in place. It suggests that they weren't there before. So why are they set in place? Because something different is happening. What's the thing that's different? Well, where have we seen thrones before? Well, we've seen thrones in the book of Revelation when the 24 elders are seated around the throne. We also see thrones being set in place in other places in the Bible when there is a judgment that's about to take place. We see a courtroom scene. This is the great courtroom scene. We see similar language to this in Psalm 2, right? That the kings of the earth rise up. They make their stand against the Lord and against his anointed. But the one enthroned in heaven laughs. He holds them in derision. So God is sitting in his throne, and there's this idea of the great heavenly courtroom, and it's pretty persistent throughout the Bible. And what we see here is this great courtroom scene. God is going to judge. When we see the term thrones are set in place, what we know is some kind of judgment is going to happen. Somebody is going to be judged. Well, who gets judged? Verse 11, then I continued to watch because of the boastful words the horn was speaking. I kept looking until the beast was slain. Notice he's called a beast now. The beast was slain and its body destroyed and thrown into the blazing fire. So now the beast seems to be united with the horn. For a long time, the beast and the horn were like two different things, right? Because there were 10 horns and just there was just one little one, but now we see the language where the beast and the horn seem to be treated as the same thing. And the beast was thrown into the blazing fire. Again, we see this when we look at the end of Revelation where the Antichrist, the false prophet, and Satan are thrown into the lake of fire, right? We see this language. This is all in keeping exactly with what John is telling us. The other beasts had been stripped of their authority. Oh, wait, so all the beasts had authority. That's interesting because we know that the leopard, that weird four-headed leopard thing, was given authority. But now we know that the other beasts had been given authority too. What does this mean? Why does this stand there? Because this suggests, if we're going to take our Bible chronology seriously, which I try to, I think we should take it as seriously as we can. We should, if something happens in order in the Bible, we should treat it chronologically, unless we have a very good reason to not. The books are opened, there's a judgment. The first beast, the last beast, the Antichrist, the false prophet, Satan. We know from Revelation 19 that whore Babylon is overthrown and it's destroyed. We know that they are cast into hell. But the other beasts continue to exist. Now you say, but Luke, how can they continue to exist if they keep getting supplanted by the other beasts? How do they continue to exist if we see in the image of the multi-metallic image, the rock smashes the feet and everything turns to dust? What does this mean? Well, now we're getting information that's slightly different from what we've seen before. Before, we saw that when the rock cut out, but not with human hands, smashes the feet made of partly iron and partly clay, that all of them turn to dust, that all the empires turn to dust. But that imagery gets clarified here because even though they lose their authority, they still exist. What is that talking about? I already mentioned this a few weeks ago. I talked about this, but it's really worth noticing. Go to the end of Zechariah. The Lord, the NIV heads this, the Lord comes and reigns. Okay, so we could read this whole section here, but we're not going to because this is all talk. You read this on your own time. This is a really good section to read, but it talks about what's going to happen in the end times. But then we see after this war is over, after God has destroyed his enemies, beginning in verse 16 of chapter 14 of Zechariah, then the survivors from all the nations that would attack Jerusalem will go up year after year to worship the King, the Lord Almighty, and to celebrate the Feast of Tabernacles. If any of the peoples of the earth do not go up to Jerusalem to worship the King, the Lord Almighty, they will have no rain. If the Egyptian people do not go up and take part, they will have no rain. The Lord will bring on them the plagues that he inflicts on the nations that do not go up to celebrate the Feast of Tabernacles. And we see these names. We see Egypt. We see Ethiopia. We see these places. They continue to survive. The fascinating thing about the end times is that nations continue to exist. If we flipped through to Revelation, we would see that the trees, right? There are 12 trees that line the river of life. And the leaves of those trees are for the healing of the what? The healings of the nations. Political nations seem to continue to exist even after Jesus is on his throne. There will still be, quite possibly, a United States when Jesus is ruling in Jerusalem. You say, well, how does that work? Well, I mean, Jesus said how it would work in the parables. He said that certain of his saints who are exceptionally trustworthy will be given authority over cities and over multiple cities. And so what it seems to mean to me is that when Jesus says that his saints will rule with him, that's a promise we saw repeatedly in chapters 2 and 3 of Revelation when he talks to the churches. He said, you will rule with me. I mean, that's a consistent promise throughout the Bible that the saints will rule with Jesus. How are they going to rule? They're going to rule during the millennium. They are going to be given authority. And their authority is largely going to correspond to political units that already exist today. Now, can I prove that? Well, no, I can't. There's no verse in the Bible that says the political units that exist today are likely going to continue into the future and Christians are going to rule those political units somehow. But it seems to make sense of the evidence, right? We know that nations exist into the millennium. We know that. We know that they're called by their national terms, Egypt, whatever. We know that those places, according to Paul, when he speaks to the Areopagus in Acts chapter 17, said that God has determined the exact times and places, the times that nations should rise and the places that they live in. So God says, I have set apart certain places for certain groups of people to live. Seems to me that the easiest solution to understanding what this means is that for a time, political nations will continue to exist as political nations. In the new heaven and the new earth, that may be different. But at least in the millennial kingdom, there will still be a United States. If America makes it to Revelation, if we make it that far, if we don't become, you know, the United States of Canada and Mexico, we will, or if there's one United States, who knows? But if we make it that far, we will continue to be a nation going on. Now, verse 13. In my vision at night, I looked, and there before me was one like a son of man. Oh, wait a second. Where have we seen son of man language? Of course, we know who the son of man is. The son of man is Jesus. I saw one like the son of man coming with the clouds of heaven. He approached the Ancient of Days and was led into his presence. He was given authority, glory, and sovereign power. All peoples, nations, and men of every language worshipped him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion, and it will not pass away, and his kingdom is one that will never be destroyed. Okay, so wait a second. This is a passage that, how should I put this? People hate. That's maybe the nicest way to put it. This is a passage that is really disturbing to people who are non-Trinitarians, to people who are non-Messianic Jews, because we have two people who are mentioned here. We have the Ancient of Days, and we have one who's like the Son of Man. They're different. They're not the same person. But the Ancient of Days gives the Son of Man authority, glory, sovereign power, and all peoples, nations, and men of every language worshipped him. Ugh. Why would God give somebody else so much authority and power that they are then worshipped? I mean, that's blasphemy, right? Isn't this exactly what the little horn gets cut out for? Isn't this why the little horn gets thrown into the lake of fire? But God is here giving him dominion, glory, power, authority. Everything the little horn wants, everything Nebuchadnezzar wanted, everything Xerxes and the Medo-Persian kings wanted, everything that Alexander and all of his generals wanted, everything that all of the Caesars wanted, glory, power, sovereign power, authority, all peoples, nations, and men of every language worshiping them, and an everlasting dominion. Whoever this person is, whoever the Son of Man is, the Son of Man is treated as an equal by God. This one is given from God the fulfillment of desire of every king who's ever lived. And thus, we can know by extension that he is the King of Kings. He is the ultimate king. He's the ultimate ruler. And he is eternal. His dominion will never pass away. Who is this? Well, I mean, Deanne's smiling because we know it's Jesus. But what does this tell us about Jesus? What does this tell us about the Son of Man? He's in charge? Yes. What else? There's something very specific that it tells us. He's God's son, yeah. What's that? It will not pass away. He's God's son, but he is God. He is mighty. He is God Almighty. Yeah, yeah. If anyone is directing, the Jews are pretty hardcore about this. God himself is pretty hardcore about this. If you worship anything or anyone other than the Lord your God, you're deserving of death. No one can receive worship except for God himself. But here, we have two people who clearly are God interacting with one another. I know of only one system of thought that explains that, and that's Trinitarianism. That's that somehow God is one God in three persons. Now, we don't see the Holy Spirit mentioned here, so I guess you could have, like, Tuitarianism here, you know, but we know better because we know how the Holy Spirit works, right, from the rest of the Bible. But there's clearly God and someone who God treats as an equal. So this is an amazing passage. This is an amazing passage. So we're not going to go into the interpretation that Daniel gives because, I mean, you can read that on your own, and it's pretty straightforward. And we see that Daniel has another vision. He has a vision of a ram and a goat. The ram and the goat vision is really interesting. We see that he has a vision of a man in chapter 10. And then in chapter 11, we see this history of the kings of the south and of the north. And so we look at the kings of the south and the north, and actually, if you have a good study Bible, the NIV study notes are actually really good on this. Just read through chapter 11 about the kings of the south and the north, and just read the notes they have, because it's amazing. It's amazing predictive prophecy. Daniel's predictions are so accurate and so spot on that people say that Daniel could not have been written when it was written. It could not have been written in 700 BC because no one can make predictive prophecy. Well, that's one way to interpret the data. The other way to interpret the data is Daniel did write it in 700 BC, which means Daniel was speaking by God's power. Anyways, I think what we're going to do next week, assuming that we have heat, because it's a little chilly, but next week when we get together, I think what we're going to do is we're going to wrap up, we're going to look at possibly this last section of Daniel, and then we're going to look at a couple other places where we see the Antichrist. So we're going to look at the end of Daniel, and we're going to look at Ezekiel, off the top of my head, Ezekiel, I want to say 28, the Prince of Tyre. So we're going to look at some of that, and then we're going to maybe do a little bit of looking at a survey of what's in Revelation. But we need to know who Antichrist is. Why do we need to know who Antichrist is? Because he is the inversion of Christ. This is a person that the Bible spends a lot of time talking about. Why? Because understanding who Antichrist is helps us to understand the world we live in. It helps us understand what God is reaching for, what God is moving the world towards. And also, it's in the text. I mean, he takes up a big portion of Revelation. So if we want to understand Revelation, we need to know who this guy is. Anyways, does anybody have any final thoughts before we wrap up? All right, get warm. Hey, thank you guys.